Thank you, everyone. I've been asked to introduce the opening speaker. I've also been asked to fix the placard, so let me get that taken care of. I'm the Chief Deputy Attorney General in the state of Idaho, and I've been sent as an emissary from that state to say, please stop moving to Idaho. We're full, and in all seriousness, it's been a real dynamic in the states of Idaho and Montana, where I served as the Solicitor General for a couple years. And I'll tell you what, almost without exception, the folks that we've met coming from California seem to be folks who actually want to escape a particular way of life and enjoy what we have on offer in the upper Mountain West. And so it's been great to get to know so many of your kindred up in those states. They're moving there for the right reasons. I have, as I said, had the honor of serving as the state solicitor general in Montana, and now as the chief deputy in the state of Idaho. And I would say one of the most exciting places to serve, particularly as it happens during Democrat administrations, is in state attorneys general offices. I mean, that's the place where you can get into the action. That's where the fight really is. And it's been great fun in both places to work for courageous and very conservative attorneys general who are willing to join the fight. So I don't have many remarks beyond that, except to say that the Federalist Society has had a huge impact on my life. From my time in law school to the various steps in my career, people like Lisa and Dean and others have been mainstays and have helped me, provided counsel. And I've met so many great friends through this program. It's an honor to be here in this beautiful place, this historic place. And without anything else, I'd like to welcome to the stage the Attorney General of the state of Idaho, Raul Labrador.
Good morning. I'm Raul Labrador. I'm honored to be here. Thank you to David, and thank you to all the dignitaries that are here. I've been in politics for a little bit. I've been a state legislator. I've been a congressman. I was in Congress for 8 years. I was the chair of the Idaho Republican Party. I'm one of the founding members of the House Freedom Caucus. If you know Ron DeSantis, Mark Meadows, Jim Jordan, myself, and a few others were the founding members of the House Freedom Caucus. And now I have the great honor of being the Attorney General for the state of Idaho. My ascent into politics started by my illustrious career as president of the University of Washington chapter of the Federalist Society. I was the president from 1994 to 1995. You see, we had a fledgling chapter at the University of Washington. In our law school, there were 7 members of the chapter. There were 7 members not because we were exclusive. There were 7 members because there were only 7 of us who were willing to stand up and claim that we were conservative, and 7 members who were stupid enough to tell our professors that we were conservative. So we had a leadership fight in the Federalist Society. Our previous president had graduated from law school, and during my 3rd year of law school, the 7 of us sat in a room, and we stared at each other for a very awkward 2 minutes, trying to decide who was going to be the president. And not a single one of us decided to volunteer for that position until somebody spoke up and nominated me to be the president. And I was stupid enough to say, sure, I can do that. So that's what started my career in politics. And I looked around the room, I shrugged my shoulders, and I said, okay, I guess I can do it. And the legend was born, right? In all seriousness, those were the years that molded the person who I later became in politics. When I was applying to law schools, I applied to about 4 or 5 law schools. And all of us who applied to law school, we applied for our dream school. And to me, that was Stanford. and then we apply to the ones that we know we're going to get into. And then we apply to some that are maybe a little bit higher than we think we can get into, but we're trying to get into those schools. And for me, those schools were Georgetown and the University of Washington. I was lucky enough to get accepted into Georgetown right away. It was within a week or two of me sending out my application. But the University of Washington, which is where I graduated from, ended up sending me a letter about within a week of me sending my application. And in the letter, they asked me to outline how I was a diverse applicant for the University of Washington. And they asked me, could I please explain how I qualify as a diversity candidate? So I sent them a really short letter that said, my name is Raul Rafael Labrador, with an accent over the U. I speak with an accent because my native language is Spanish, since I was born and raised in Puerto Rico, and I moved from Puerto Rico at the age of 13. English is my second language that I've had to learn so I can go through an education process and graduate from college, take the LSAT, and apply for law school. However, if the only reason that you're accepting me is because I'm Hispanic, please, I hereby withdraw my application. Within 5 days, I received an acceptance. And unfortunately for me at the time, but it was wonderful for me and my wife. My wife, who was going to actually work through law during the years of law school, she and I got pregnant, and the only law school I could afford that was a highly qualified law school is University of Washington. I really wanted to go to Georgetown. I just could not afford going to Georgetown. So we ended up going to the University of Washington. But that's what started my career at the University of Washington. During my first year at the University of Washington Law School, I had a professor called Louis Wolcher. I don't know how many of you know who he is, but he was one of the biggest proponents of critical legal studies. And he was our contracts professor. Think about that. He was our contracts professor. And he was one of those really charming professors that would speak up and always paint his side of the policy discussions and the debates in just a very charming light. And every student in first year contracts loved this professor. But I always found that he was always using these straw man arguments. Like, he would make these arguments that were completely false, but they sounded so credible that everybody was buying them. And of course, I wasn't the person that I am today. And I was scared out of my wits in that class because I would hear him say things and I'm like, I just don't think he's clearly outlining what the other side thinks about this issue, and he's not being fair, but I didn't know how to say it. And in the middle of the class, first semester in law school, I finally just got fed up, and I just raised my hand, and with a broken voice and just with all fear in my voice, I said, I think you're being totally unfair to the other side. And that's all I could say. But that's what started my belief that we needed to challenge what the other side was saying, and also learned that in a class of 100 or so students, I was one of the few that was willing to stand up and say it. Eventually, I became much more comfortable with challenging the premises of what my professors were saying. So in my last year of law school, when I took family law, I did it quite often. And in family law, we also had a very liberal professor who was always advocating what we would call today woke theories about family law and other areas. And I eventually became known as the Victorian one who was sitting in the top. So every time that I said something, she would say, well, I guess we need to hear from the Victorian one who's sitting up there. Well, it really is a tremendous honor for me to speak to you today. And it's a tremendous honor for me because Ronald Reagan, like for many of you, Ronald Reagan is one of my heroes. He's been a political hero and inspiration to many of us that he has actually played especially significant part in my life. You see, as I share with you, I was born and raised in Puerto Rico, and my mom was a staunch Democrat. In fact, she was such a staunch Democrat. She loved the Kennedy family. And in 1979, 1980, if you guys remember, whether from history or from memory, Ted Kennedy was running for president. And that was the first year that Puerto Ricans got to vote in a primary, in a presidential primary. So Ted Kennedy actually went to Puerto Rico, and he visited the island. He campaigned for president. If I remember correctly, I think he even won Puerto Rico that year in the primary, one of the few places that I think he won. And my mother took me to that. I was 9 or 10 years old. I'm sorry, I was 11 or 12 years old at the time. And she took me to this thing. And I remember being on somebody's shoulder as a young boy and just screaming Ted Kennedy's name and being so excited that Ted Kennedy was there. So everything I knew about politics was the Kennedys, the Democratic Party, and if you're Puerto Rican, you debate the statehood issue. And I remember just sitting there, always listening to these debates and discussions about statehood, the Kennedys, and the Democratic Party. So in 1981, my mother, who worked in the hotel industry in Puerto Rico, made a very momentous decision for me and her. She was a single mom, I was her only child. And we were talking about moving to the mainland. But the whole time we were talking about the mainland, we were talking about Florida, about Miami. And I was so excited to be moving to Miami, and she decided to move me to Las Vegas. For her, it made total sense because she was in the hotel industry, and Las Vegas in 1981 was booming. She thought she was going to have a lot of opportunities. For me, it was the end of my life. I was 13 years old. I lived a block from the beach. We were poor. I didn't know it because I had the beauty of the island. We had great food. I was able to pretty much have a pretty free life. And then she moves me to the middle of the desert, in the middle of the United States, to one of the ugliest areas of the United States. So I was really bummed. And I have a lot of other stories that I can share about you. But one of the things that happened is that she was really excited because as a Puerto Rican in Puerto Rico, she had never been able to vote in a presidential election. She voted in the primary for the first time for Ted Kennedy, but had never been able to vote in a presidential election or vote for a member of Congress, really, or anything like that. So she went to register to vote. And when she went to register to vote, if those were the days where you registered in a home, so you look for the local precinct committee person, and the local precinct committee person would sign you up. And when she went to register to vote, she went to register as a Republican at the Republican precinct committee person's house. I was so confused. Again, I'm just a young kid, 13 years old. I had just been screaming a year before Ted Kennedy's name. I'm like, what are you doing? Why are you registering as a Republican? And she said, because of Ronald Reagan. She said that Ronald Reagan had changed the course of this nation and that she wanted to proudly cast her first vote for a president for Ronald Reagan, and she wanted to do it as a Republican. And in me, that brought about a desire to know who this person was. Why would a person, my mom, if you knew her, she passed away 18 years ago. My mom was a very strong-willed woman. She didn't like anybody telling her what to do. She didn't take no very kindly. She taught me to be a strong man, to believe in myself. She always told me that it didn't matter what background I came from, I could become anything I wanted to become. I could do anything that I wanted to do, and that I should never let anything stand in her way. So I wanted to know how this strong woman, who I admire so much and I love so much, how she had changed her politics, which obviously in our family, in our life, it was a very important part of our lives. So I spent my youth just learning a little bit about the president and why he was so great and the things that he stood for. And I realized that everything Reagan stood for were actually the principles and the values that my mother had instilled in me. And it made me realize that I, too, was a Republican. And as a young man, I became a Republican. I wasn't one of those nerdy Republicans that was a young Republican or anything like that. I just knew within myself. Sorry if I'm offending half of the room, but... But I just didn't get that involved in politics really until I got involved with the Federalist Society. But I just knew within, just deeply, that that was the party that I wanted to associate myself with. Reagan was known, as we all know, as the great communicator, not only because he was a polished, charismatic speaker, but most importantly because he's remembered as the great communicator because he never shied away from substance. He said real things, expressed complex ideas, and articulated first principles in a way that people could easily understand. His words helped Americans like my mother awaken not merely from economic and social unrest, but from moral disorder and despair. In 1983, in his famous speech about the evil empire, outlining the struggle against communism, he distilled the real dilemma. He said, quote, "The real crisis we face today is a spiritual one. At root, it is a test of moral will and faith," close quote. He might as well have been talking about today. Like Reagan then and many other great men and women throughout our history, we are facing the same totalitarian ideas that seem to fade for a time, but they never die and they always come back. For years, we've trained our sights on an overreaching government that chronically exceeds its bounds. That's accurate, of course. It continues to encroach upon nearly every aspect of everyday life. But most troubling is what this ever-expanding government has used its power to do. We look around now and see not just a balance of powers out of kilter. We see now how those in power have marshaled those forces to advance dangerous, un-American, and immoral policy goals. They have used government to make their goals inevitable and to coerce Americans into accepting those goals. But as I have already said, the struggle is not new. More than 100 years before Reagan, in one of the most read works of Frederick Bastiat, The Law, Bastiat recognized that the greatest threat to liberty is government. He understood that bureaucrats and socialists and communists and social scientists, am I repeating myself? They want to play God. They believe they can mold men like the farmer can work with his land and seed and soil. They do not trust that man is good and capable of greatness. Only they are good, only they are great and capable of greatness. Only their intercession for mankind can determine the destiny of man. Think about how conceited and evil that belief system can be. That's why Reagan called communism the evil empire. Thank God for states, or at least some of them, the states that can still provide a different model, an original American model, that makes decency and morality and human flourishing the norm and the goal. The states can protect our children from woke racial and gender ideologies that poison the mind, stoke hatred and suspicion among neighbors and even families, and promote harmful thinking and behavior. We protect the dignity of the human being at every stage of maturity. We can protect the rights of religious exercise and free speech, the right to keep and bear arms, the right to have your vote count, to protect and enjoy property, to live your life free from the benevolent oppressions of power-hungry, unctuous public health experts, and to shake off the yoke of smug bureaucrats. States aren't just laboratories of democracy. They are, or at least can be, walled castles of common sense, morality, and freedom. But the feds hate this. They hate it, and for years they've let them spread their tentacles into the sovereign authority of the states through acquiescence, political weakness, and the lure of that sweet federal money. As a state attorney general, my job is to fight back. We stand on the ramparts and say stop. We defend the laws and policies of our people and fight every attempt by DC bureaucrats and state radical organizations to redefine for our citizens the concepts of right and wrong. It's a constant fight, but it's a fight that I think and I believe is worth having. One that's become more and more necessary as a means of simply protecting our constitutional order. That's why one of the first things I did is when I became Idaho Attorney General is I reestablished an office of Solicitor General for the state of Idaho. Idaho hasn't had one for decades, and so it's never taken a leading or active role in the fight against the federal government. We're years behind some of our sister states, but we're working hard now to join the fight and to do our part to make federal overreach painful for the federal government. But that federal infiltration runs deep. In the last couple of weeks, I've had to start pushing back against Idaho school districts blindly adopting radical gender-affirming policies that brush aside parents and instill a set of values that the state has clearly rejected. Right on cue, many school districts and school leaders are claiming they have no choice but to adopt these policies because the Biden administration, his Department of Justice, of Education, says that they have to. Hostile bureaucrats and NGOs live inside the walls of our state, and we must fight them. My job is to root out and make sure our citizens understand that they have a right to live according to the values that they have articulated. That view of the job is quite new to Idaho. For the last 20 years, the Attorney General of the state of Idaho has been a good gentleman, but who believed incorrectly that the role of the Attorney General was merely to call balls and strikes. But that sounds to me more like a judicial role than an advocacy role for the Attorney General of a state. And that's not the leadership that I believe is required of an Attorney General. I ran against him in the primary and I was successful in Idaho for the first time in 30 years as an Attorney General that will stand up to the federal bureaucracy and to the bureaucrats in the state of Idaho. So as President Reagan said in that same 1983 speech, quote, "I urge you to beware of the temptation blithely to declare yourselves above it all and label both sides equally at fault." I'll use my own words, to call balls and strikes. "To ignore the facts of history and the aggressive impulses of an evil empire, and thereby remove yourself from the struggle between right and wrong, good and evil." We've been debating the rules of the game for a long time, while the other side has been playing it, and playing it well to the detriment of our liberties. They brought governmental, cultural, and even corporate power to bear in service of their agenda. It's time for us to start playing hardball and to stop just calling balls and strikes. I'm excited to be doing that alongside so many of you. Thank you very much, and may God bless you.